Welcome to Season 5 of Marvel's Voices. I'm your host, Angelique Roche. We're starting the season off strong with a double header. This week and next week, celebrating the growing legacy of Marvel's Voices. Marvel's Voices started 4 years ago with this podcast. Our first episode was with actor Jeremy Harris, and it dropped in 2018. 2 years later, our first comics anthology was published, Marvel's Voices number 1. And this year, we're celebrating 4 years of Marvel's Voices with nearly 70 episodes and 8 anthologies so far, spotlighting creators and characters representing various communities. Today's episode is coming out right between two milestones on our Marvel's Voices journey. On January 25th, the Marvel's Voices trade paperback was published, Marvel's Voices Legacy, which includes Marvel's Voices number 1, Marvel's Voices Legacy 2021, plus reprints of significant stories, brand new essays, and excerpts of interviews from some of your favorite Marvel's Voices podcast episodes. And next week, Marvel's Voices Legacy 2022 will be out. So between this week and next, we're doing something special to celebrate. I'll be talking to two artists who have worked on Marvel's Voices Legacy over the years. The theme of this season is the evolution of the Marvel mythos. So I'll start by talking today to an absolute legend, artist Ryan Stelfreeze. And next week, you'll hear from a part of the next generation of Marvel creators. Ryan and I get into his background, his love of storytelling, and how his work has evolved since starting in comics in the late 1980s. Let's check it out. Okay, first of all, it is really a pleasure to meet you. I am a fan. It's been very cool watching to see your artwork be included in Marvel's Voices, but also you've done some incredible work in your lifetime. So thank you for making the time.
It's a misnomer to even call it work. I've had some incredible fun in my lifetime. But if you want to misconstrue that as work, I'll take it. There's a number of people that I think conspire to build this narrative that you can't do what you want. So things like this kind of create situations where people go, oh, wait a minute, maybe I can.
You can.
And oftentimes you have to hunt for it.
Well, and I think that's a really good point. And I think that's actually a great segue into some of my questions. We kind of don't always know that the jobs that give us joy exist. But you have been a comic book fan for a really long time. Talk to me about when you first became a comic book fan. Let's just take a step back.
Oh, I can barely remember that. I was a comic book fan for as long as I can really remember. I grew up in a weird situation where my mom is from the country and my dad was a military guy. So every 3 years, we'd live in the country in a one-stoplight town. And then we'd go to a military base in New York or Colorado or somewhere like that. So it was like this strange, brackish kind of way of living. But the interesting thing is there were always comic book buddies. You know, there was just like built-in comic book buddies no matter where I went. And if I could find the comic book shop or the newsstand that had comics, there were probably buddies hanging out there. And I was attracted to that part of comics. And comics, quite frankly, gave me a love for drawing because I think you always want to recreate the thing that you love. So I would see comics, I'd see the drawings, and I'd try to do those drawings. That's the thing that got me really into it, is just the sheer availability of it.
It sounds like comics for you, and I don't want to call you a military brat, but that's how.
Oh, no. I wear it with honor.
That is something that I've known. Like, I've grown up with a lot of friends who are military brats, and there's always this hard time getting that common language, right?
Oh, yeah. And it was like kind of strange because to a certain extent, it was tabula rasa every 3 years. All your friends that you have, just wipe the board clean, and start over again. Like you said, having that common language of, oh, I see that there's a comic book shop over here. I know that there are people that are going to be just like me there. So it was cool.
Now, comics are continuously evolving. So as much as you're moving, comics are also shifting and growing, and the characters are changing. And you've kind of lived through a lot of major shifts in the industry. What kept you engaged in comics?
Well, the odd thing about it is I was absolutely engaged in comics until there was one extent where we moved back to South Carolina and there wasn't really any comic book shops. And in the town that my mom was from, I think there were two comic book fans. it was me and my buddy Anthony. We were it. We were the entire comic book contingent. It was just kind of a real drought for a little bit. And I had still gotten the bug for drawing, but because the availability wasn't there for most of my high school years, I kind of drifted out of comics altogether. And my focus kind of moved from comics to illustration. And that's when I got into drawing and cartooning and things like that. But I had completely walked away from comics for about 4 years. It wasn't until I moved to Atlanta and met a new group of comic book buddies that kind of drew me back in.
You have in the past talked about how art is like storytelling. I remember seeing your variant cover for Marvel's Voices #1. That piece for me was such a wonderful piece of storytelling, right? You got the old head sitting in the chair. You got Luke and T'Challa and Misty and Storm, like all the ones getting their fresh cuts. And if you look very closely, you got the little young blood sitting in the back, waiting their turn to get into the chair with Riri and Miles. Why was this the story you wanted to tell in this piece, and like, how did you approach it? Because I know there's a very special place in the Black community that is the barbershop.
Well, it's, to me, that's the best thing about storytelling. Is storytelling is a way of illustrating where you've been, illustrating where you're going to be, and illustrating where you are. You know, everything we do is about pattern recognition, and the storytellers are the people that explain these patterns. And what I thought was fun about that, I'm a gray beard now, but I've had every step of those experiences. I was the young kid sitting there with Miles and Riri hanging out. I can't participate in the conversations. I'm just kind of overhearing it. And then I've been the slightly older, you know, where I'm not quite there, but I'm getting to be there. And now, and the cool thing about it is that's my barbershop that they're sitting in. It's so cool to be sitting in that chair joking with the barber, but at the same time, I can see the younger kids waiting their turn. That's a maturation plot in a single image. From that image, and everyone in our community recognizes that. So that's an illustration that tells you where you are, tells you where you've been, and tells you where you're going to be. And anytime you can do that in storytelling, that's the best thing.
And I love that because there was a very specific choice in using T'Challa, first Black superhero, Luke Cage, first Black superhero to get his solo title, Misty Knight and Storm. They're really doing this kind of lineage. It also shows how there's been this evolution and change in the industry in regards to representation in comics and how it's continuously evolving.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you remember being represented in comics, and like, were there particular comic characters that resonated with you as a young man?
Well, I think the important thing about that, especially as a storyteller, is remembering not only being represented, but remembering being excluded. All of that is massively important because I think the exclusion adds just as much fuel as the representation. And for me, even as a young kid, I remember there was an issue of Iron Fist with the Wrecking Crew, and it was illustrated by Gil Kane. And I remember as just a young kid seeing the Wrecking Crew and the main character who's got this big wrecking ball and he's like slamming it down on Iron Fist. And I remember looking at that cover as a young kid going, that's a sweet afro that guy has, you know? And there's something so endearing about that, kind of going, wow, I'm recognizing his Blackness and I'm recognizing his kinship to me in this cover that has nothing to do about that. It's nothing to do about that, but there's that familiarity. There's that I can empathize with this. And the coolest thing for me was when I first became familiar with the Black Panther, he was in his costume. this is like an issue of the Avengers. And I just saw this character that looked cool. And I'm reading his story, I'm reading his interactions with the other character. And then later in the issue, he takes off his mask. And it was so amazing to be in love with his character first, because I thought the character was cool, but then finding out it was a Black character. And I love that. I love when characters are handled like that.
All right, so fast forward, you have now had this substantial career. You are still doing incredible work. But before you worked in comics, you had a whole several other lives. You've done so much incredible stuff. You were an editorial cartoonist at a local paper. You did airbrush on Myrtle Beach. Like, yeah. Then you go to the Art Institute of Atlanta and you do illustrations for a major studio and then start your own thing. Like, you've done stuff for Coca-Cola. Like, How do you then re-meet your best friend comics after all of this incredible work? And do you feel like this work impacted your craft along the way?
I think that was an absolutely necessary distraction. I think that distraction has made me a better husband, in that if I had gotten directly into comics, I would be a storyteller that had no story to tell. I think I benefited from the fact that I got a chance to live my life. I got a chance to build skills apart from comics, and then later bring all of that back into comics. So I think that was just one of those absolutely great distractions, because as a young comic book artist, I would have been just too much of a dude, where my attitude is like, well, this guy is better than this guy because he can beat him. that's it. That would have been my entire weight makes great kind of attitude. I mean, I got a chance to accept and understand nuance, to live my life for a little while, brought me to comics as a much more mature storyteller rather than just an action director.
One of the things I love about your style is your use of color, the variations in tone and skin tone. How would you personally describe your style and what your intention is that you set forth into a piece?
Well, really, my approach to storytelling is that the inside is, to me, oftentimes more truthful than the outside. And what I try to do is I try to make an attempt to illustrate the inside while illustrating the majesty and the beauty of the outside. It's sometimes trying to capture just a subtle expression that makes you see the truth. And the truth isn't in those necessarily bright colors. It isn't in the symmetry of the design or anything like that. The truth is that thing that you feel when you look at it. It's almost an attitude of, well, I'm going to sugarcoat this pill so that you can enjoy it a little bit easier. And I think a part of that comes from my life. And I think every person of color can actually identify with that, with the fact that the truth is not always on the surface. it's like you might think this is going on the surface, but underneath there's a whole lot going on, and that's the truth. And I think because of that story that I want to illustrate, that is something that works with these complex characters. And even when Ta-Nehisi came to me with this story of Wakanda, let's take a look at the dichotomy, sort of the juxtaposition of this. And the moment I heard that, I was just like, oh, I'm the guy for that. I'm the guy to illustrate that. And even in a city like that, to understand that this is Black paradise, but at the same time, no, it's not. there's a lot of problems going on there, and we will address both. And for me, that's my definition of truth. And that's what I try to go for in the art, is I want there to be an attractive aesthetic, something that's gonna make you look at it. You know, I don't want to do anything repulsive, but sometimes what I have to say is repulsive, but I'm gonna try to get you to look at it first, and then find it within that gaze. So sometimes the pieces I do get a little darker the more you stare.
Well, and I think it's interesting because you mentioned Black Panther, which you worked on with writer Ta-Nehisi Coates beginning in 2016. You rarely do interiors.
Yeah.
But you did them for Black Panther. Now, one, that's a jump. Cover, interiors, time commitment.
Oh, yeah.
Completely different.
Yeah, yeah. Different story altogether.
Talk a little bit about why, because you could have just said, hey, I'm just doing the covers. Like, I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. And originally, that was kind of my thought. And the reason for that is, as a storyteller, I want some meat on the bones. And there's no secret that a lot of comics just don't have that much meat on the bones. So if I'm going to do the interior, I want something that is, to a certain extent, worth me taking a cut in pay. Because I make much more doing commercial work and I make much more doing covers than I do doing interiors. So I'd like for the story to move me to want to invest that kind of energy into doing interior work. And once I saw where they were going with Black Panther, I was just like, okay, yeah, I'm absolutely on board. I'll take a minimum wage for this. I'm good. You know?
The other thing I want to talk about, you have this wonderful awareness of color and tone and highlighting and depth in your work, particularly when it comes to skin tone and texture of character. Do you feel like your various background, like moving around and being exposed to different cultures, influenced how your art has manifested and how your storytelling has evolved?
Oh, without a doubt. Absolutely without a doubt. And I don't think I could do what I'm doing without having that experience. Because as creators, to a certain extent, we're liars. And like, if you're going to lie, you should know the truth, you know, and you should see that lie with as much truth as possible. And I think creators, we're chroniclers. We have not only the ability to record, but we have the ability to playback, and playback in such a way that the people who listen to our stories get it. But we're going to change a few things around, you know, to make things more dramatic or more personal or whatever. But you have to know the truth. If you don't know the truth, then your story falls into the uncanny valley and it becomes absurd. The more truth that you're aware of, the greater the fantasy you're able to tell.
You're taking the audience, the viewer, the reader, it's a journey. You've also kind of gone through this journey, right? You started comics in the 80s, which was a very different time in the industry, down to how comics were physically made and produced.
Oh, yeah, completely different.
How have you seen the industry change and storytelling change as you evolve from fan to creator, but just overall?
Well, I think there's a strange thing that's happening in every storytelling medium, which is access. The interesting thing, when you look at movies, I mean, back in the day, the studios ruled everything. And if you couldn't get a job at a studio, well, you may as well get a job sweeping the floors. And that got broken and then broken again. And then when we got to the point of video and we got to the point of, especially now with the internet, you can do your own TV show if you want to. You have direct access to your fans. That to me is the greatest thing as far as storytelling is concerned. Because, I mean, before, you might have an idea that only 100,000 people are interested in. Well, that's not enough for a single company. You know, they don't care about a mere 100,000 people. But now, as a creator, if you have 100,000 people interested in what you have to do, you can make a living off of that. And I think that is the biggest change in the industry. And I think that change happened in sequence with a number of other changes. More people with very specific stories wanted to tell those stories. And I think that's why there's a lot more women in comics. I think that's why there's a lot more LGBTQ people that are participating in the storytelling field. And it's been sometimes a Sisyphus change, but it's happened. And I think it's the tools for doing the work. You don't have to worry about printing if you don't want to anymore. These things are great. I still have an obsession with Marvel characters. So now I have the ability to jump in and do some Marvel stuff, to do some Spider-Man, to do some Miles, to do some Black Panther. But at the same time, I can jump out and I can do my own thing. Those opportunities are available for everyone now. And one big compliment that I have to give Marvel Comics is Marvel Comics has gone from being the studio that's the wall between creators and fans, and they've tried to get in this position of being the facilitator, where it's like, okay, we understand that you have this story. Well, why don't you use the vehicle of this character to tell your story? And I think that's just absolutely wonderful that we're getting that today.
Has there been anyone in the industry who you took on as a mentor or inspiration? Because clearly your art style is unique, but I know artists have a family within comics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of people that sometimes, unbeknownst to them, I have made myself their apprentice, simply because I'm just a huge fan of either their work or their voice. Jim Steranko is a person, you know, I absolutely admired his work growing up, and I've met him as a fan and later met him as a friend. And he's a guy that I relish a conversation with him every opportunity, because he is such a scholar, and the work that he does, nothing is a mistake. Everything is put there on purpose. And Walt Simonson, I consider Walt Simonson my comic book dad. He's like just the perfect comic book artist, the perfect storyteller, and the perfect human being. And every time I have a conversation with Walt, there's a lesson that's in the air. And even folks like Dennis Cowan, much like the Black Panther, I admired his work and then found out later. It's like, oh, he's a brother. Okay. So it's kind of cool to see stuff like that.
Well, and I think that goes into what you said earlier about the variant cover. When you were talking about the variant cover, you talk about being the young blood in the chair, the younger guy, and now being the gray hair.
Yeah.
The chair. You know, that being said, any advice or pearls of wisdom for aspiring artists who are currently working in the field or want to?
Yeah. A thing that I always come back to is the question why. Every other question is a follow-up question. If you want to be a comic book artist, if you want to be a comic book creator, you got to ask yourself why. And if the serious answer to that question is anything other than because I have a story to tell, because I have something to say, because I'm compelled to do it. If the answer to that why is anything other than those, then please, dear God, find another profession, because you'll do much better in all of those other professions. If you're doing this to make money, oh, that's a failed idea. And it took me a while. It took me a while to get around to this. But I was falsely under the impression that I loved comics because of the art. And then I became falsely under the impression that I loved comics because of the superheroes and because of the characters. And it wasn't until I became an adult that I looked back at the arc that I just crossed. And I realized that even when I was a young kid growing up in a Gullah Geechee community, what was awesome about that is that my great-grandmother was the matriarch. And on Sundays after church, everyone would come over to her house, sit down, and they were telling stories. You know, my Uncle Herbert would get up and he would tell a story. My Aunt Sheila, she would be telling a story. And as a kid, I used to love listening to these stories. And some of the stories were absurd. Some of the stories were old stories about, you know, years past and all this stuff. And I was always fascinated by that. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized that's why I love comics. It has nothing to do with the drawing. The drawing is just a tool. It has nothing to do with the superheroes. The superheroes are just tools. You know, the reason why I love comics is because that is the best way for me to express myself as a storyteller.
So we're at our third year of Marvel's Voices Comics, and it started off as an idea. It was a kernel of how do we bring artists and writers of color and journalists of color together to talk about culture and comics. We've already talked about the dope barbershop variant cover. Again, it is the personification of what the book is. It is the barbershop of comics. Did you think that something like Marvel's Voices would exist when you first started in comics?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Here's the thing. I think the barbershop analogy is apropos here, because what you're talking about is sometimes small stories in an even smaller room, but they're massively important. And I think sometimes there might be only one person that can really fully appreciate the story that you're telling, but you still have to tell it. And with all of the big movies and all of the big TV shows and all of this big stuff, everyone is interested in telling these large stories about saving the world, you know, and this is going to be news to you, but that's not everyone's story, you know, saving the world. Sometimes your story is really a small story, best to be told in a small room. And that to me is one of the most awesome thing about Marvel Voices. Because it's small stories told in a small room, they're infinitely more truthful. You know, it's superhero characters, but you recognize yourself. You recognize the people that are closest to you in these small stories. That's the thing that blows me away. There's a lot of people where if they don't see someone like themselves, that's catastrophic. That hurts them. They might feel that, oh, my voice isn't important. There aren't any people like me telling stories like mine. So they check out. They check out, they go a different way, they chase another dream because this one's too hard. And I think a book like Marvel Voices, that helps those people on the margins that need to hear these stories kind of go, yeah, I'm worth it. You know, and it makes those people that are on the margin that want to become storytellers kind of go, well, that person did it. And if that person did it, that means there isn't a gatekeeper, or at least the gatekeeper is letting a few of them through. Maybe I can get in there. The benefits of that is absolutely amazing. I think that is the most important thing about something like Marvel Voices. And the title, Voices, is perfect. Because now you get to walk away from the world saving, there's a person that's going to snap their fingers and destroy the universe, and get into these other stories.
Yeah. How were you first approached to participate in Marvel's Voices?
I was asked, hey, you know, we're doing this thing, Marvel's Voices, you know, like, you're the Black Panther guy. You know, it's like, we have a sneaking suspicion you might be a person of color, you know, which... would you want to do something like this? And the more I thought about it, the more I was just like, huh, you know, it'd be fun. You know, and that is what got me going, because I can do something that's just really cool on a cover. You know, you want me to do a Black Bolt cover, I can do something just really cool looking. But Marvel Voices isn't about that. It isn't about like the bang zoom of superheroes. I wanted to do something that spoke to those quiet stories. And that gets me off of my ego mountain as a creator and puts me on my little truthful hill as a truth teller. And that's where the barbershop idea came from. And that's the thing that I'm really incredibly proud to be able to contribute to something like that, because I didn't want to do something big. I wanted to do something small. And it's kind of cool because when people come up to me for a lot of the cover images that I've done, it's always, oh, dude, you know, it's always big. It's always big. But when someone comes up to me to talk to me about the barbershop cover, it's usually quiet. It's usually, yeah, man. And there's a different sort of feel altogether. And it's almost like everyone just kind of walks up and goes, I know, and then walks away. You know? So it's really awesome that you put a story or stories like that out there.
I love it. So we've got Marvel's Voices Legacy, both the trade and the comic book. Last year's was Marvel's Voices Legacy number one in 2021. For you, what does the word legacy mean as it pertains to comics?
The word legacy for me is something that's really tricky because it's something that you leave in place. It's a truth that you've told or that you've done that's so profound that it remains indelible. I think a lot of times we get confused between truth and fashion. They oftentimes can masquerade as each other. And you can do something that grabs a lot of attention and it feels truthful at the time, but it's actually just fashionable. And history is not good to fashion, but history celebrates the truth. And I think legacy is when you can kind of figure out the difference, when you can actually, through your actions or through your works, leave something that remains on the page, that remains in the minds, that remains in the hearts of people. And I think legacy is a very complex bit of alchemy. Oftentimes, you got to get out of your own way in order to do that. And the things that I consider legacy are the things that I look back on now and I appreciate it with the same level of honor.
So what do you hope your legacy as an artist will be?
That's really tricky. It's tough as an artist. For me, meeting with any level of success is a lottery win. You know, I mean, you've somehow scratched the right card or put down the right numbers and you win the lottery. You have become a professional artist. A lot of times it's not the quality of your work. It's kind of tricky to pull this off. The funny thing about even doing this interview is like my original intent when I decided to be a comic book artist was I was going to be in a little dark studio and I was going to just draw superheroes doing awesome things. And I was going to send those images off to Marvel. And every couple of weeks, I'd go down to the comic book shop and go, yeah, there's a comic book I did. And that was going to be my life. And I was actually going to be happy with that. But now I get to do stuff like this. I get to fly all over the world. I've gotten to talk to the presidents of different countries from being a comic book artist. But I still, even to this day, ultimately, just being in that dark apartment, drawing pages, would still be my definition of happiness. And I would still do that if everything else disappeared. But one of the things that gave me the luck that I got is the aegis of others. The fact that so many great artists took the time to kind of talk to me, give me some encouragement, show me a little technique here or there. I mean, I went 1 year of Art Institute. So most of what I know was borrowed from guys who just decided to throw knowledge table scraps my way. So what I try to do is understand that I was, to a certain extent, a waste of their time. So I try to pay that time forward. So I'm going to allow the next generation to waste some of my time. And I'm going to try to pass on as much of the things that I've learned to them as I possibly can. I would like to be remembered for one of the things that I always say is, I think that there's an Olympic torch that goes back to before the cave drawings in Lascaux of one artist passing a skill down to another, passing a skill down to another, passing a skill down to another. And I'd like to be remembered for the guy that held the torch for a little while and did some cool things and then passed it on to the next generation. That is the only immortality that we're allowed, is did you do something cool for the time that you were here? And did you pass that knowledge on to the next generation who will hopefully do something just a little bit cooler with it? Thank you.
this was the perfect way to kick off season 5 of Marvel's Voices and to celebrate Marvel's Voices' legacy. Brian ended our conversation talking about his own legacy and passing the torch to the next generation. What better way to follow up this incredible conversation than with next-gen artist Torrin Clark? Torrin drew a cover for Marvel's Voices Legacy number 1 last year and has gone on to continue doing some incredible work at Marvel, including a cover for this year's Marvel's Voices Legacy. We'll be talking about all of that and more next week. In the meantime, make sure you check out Marvel's Voices Legacy number 1. It's available wherever you get your comics on February 16th. Marvel's Voices is produced by Isabel Robertson and me, Angelique Rocher. Our creative producer is Harry Goh. Our senior manager of audio production and development is Brad Barton. Our production manager is Larissa Rosen. And our executive producer is Jill Duboff. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kamal Wainaina.